Good morning. Good morning. Well, I have a little inkling of what I want to talk about this morning, which is more than usual. But especially with what I want to discuss, there's two ways, you know, to engage in, I hate to say listening because that puts it, it puts you in too much of a uninvolved role, you know. But nonetheless, since I don't know a better word, there are different ways of listening. There's a listening that I think most of us are familiar with. We were trained in it very astutely going through school, where we were taught to listen with our mind, where we're listening for information. And that's what we're trained to do. You know, our minds, for the most part, a lot to listen for information, grasp it, try to understand it, and try to remember it. So that's one way of listening with our mind. So when we're listening with our mind, we're listening simply to information, simply to the words spoken, you might say, which cuts us off. You know, we're kind of cut off. We're like, we're only existing from sort of the shoulders up when we're listening with our mind. So when we listen with our whole being, you realize that you actually can listen with your entire being. It's not as mysterious as it might sound. It happens, say, if you were to go outside on a sunny day to a nice park or in the woods and you lay down on the grass and the sun shining on your face and you can feel the warmth on your face and on your arms and in your legs and you can hear the breezes, that a nice gentle breeze is sort of blowing across your body, and maybe you're lying in a park and you hear in sort of the distance the laughter of children around and the occasional parents and, you know, the dog walking past, and all this where you're listening in a very easy way, but with your whole being, right? You're not listening when you're laying on the grass like that, like you're listening when you're in a classroom, right? You're not obsessed with information. You're just letting all of your sort of senses take everything in through all of your senses all at once. So that's a different type of listening. I would suggest that's more of a conducive type of listening to what we're all doing here. And then underneath that is more of a sort of an energetic listening. In Zen, we say, you know, there's two types of a teaching, two ways that they are engaged with. One is through just what's said, and then another way is through the transmission of the teaching. The transmission of the teaching is simply that when what's said is coming from the actual experience of what's being talked about. That makes sense? So someone could talk about something and they really maybe they've never experienced it, they can still talk about it. Maybe they have experienced it, but they're not experiencing it at that moment, they can talk about it from memory. Or someone can actually be in the experience they're talking about, and when they are, that sort of transmits something. By transmit, I don't mean that it's something is given from one to the other. Transmission is actually something more like having two musical instruments, one in one part of the room and another in another part. And if you string the D note on one of those stringed instruments, the other one at the other end of the room, that note is going to start to vibrate. It's actually going to start to vibrate. And that musical instrument that nobody touched is actually going to start to make a sound. That's a very demystified version of what transmission is. And it's useful to understand because it's not something that's given one to the other. That makes sense? Which is very different, by the way, than an energy thing. You can give other people energy. You know, you can do all sorts of energy transfers and you can put people into blissful states and all other kinds of nonsense. You know, and that's fine and that's well and good, but I'm not interested in that at all. You know, that's like spiritual candy. And, you know, you may or may not experience something on that level too, but that's not as important as the more subtle thing, the deeper part of the transmission, which isn't just, you know, how I feel, but what I'm actually experiencing. So just keeping in mind that this a bigger way to listen, and when you're listening in this way, you're actually engaged, right? You're not just you're actually then a participant in what's happening. Then I'm just not speaking to you, that it's something that we're actually doing together. We both have to bring all of ourselves to the table, you know? So it's a very engaged way of being. Because otherwise, what I will probably talk about will just seem overly academic. And I'm not talking about it from an academic point of view. I'm talking about it from an experiential point of view. So I don't know how your mind works. We all have different minds. My mind works in images, which is a great thing most of the time, and occasionally it's not. You know? Because anything that I think, I have an image of. And anything someone says to me, I get an image of it. And generally that's good, you know, unless somebody's trying to talk about images you don't want to have in your head. You know? Sometimes my wife will play with me in that way, and she'll say things simply because I don't know, generate an image in my head, and then she'll laugh about it. You know? She'll know what she's doing. So I love images. So I'm going to use sort of an image. And again, don't try to understand what I'm saying as if it's sort of very concretely, this is the way it is. This is sort of, it's something you have to kind of get the feel of, the sense of. It's something you kind of take in and see how it is for you, okay? So I think we all are very well aware, even if we don't have any concrete definition for it, but I think we're pretty aware of what ego is. Do you know? Ego structure. As a way of having an image, I think that makes it very easy to get what ego is if you just imagine, you know those, when you have a, you ever seen those big, they're kind of like a big plastic ring with a little handle, and then you put them in like soap bubbles, and then you make these huge bubbles in the air, you know? If you imagine like those huge transparent bubbles just sort of wobbling around, you know? I love watching those things. Anyway, if you imagine a big transparent bubble, right? And in that transparent bubble is another little transparent bubble. Now, if you think in terms of the outward part of the outward dimension of that bubble, it's transparent, right? So it's, you can see it. It's there, but it's also, you can see through it, right? Just like bubbles, you can see through them. So from that outward surface of that bubble, that's what I'm going to call self. We could call it soul. We'll get back to this stuff in a moment. And what self is generally, in most human beings' experience, looking at, almost continuously, obsessed with, mesmerized by, hypnotized by, is this little bubble inside of it. And that it's always looking at is ego. In this little bubble, it talks a lot. It's not just a bubble. It's a very communicative bubble. And it talks to itself about itself. And a lot of the talk that it talks about itself is not particularly nice talk. Occasionally it's nice, but really it's not usually particularly nice talk. It's a little divisive, you know. And then it talks about other people and other events, the past. It talks about the present. It's interpreting the present always. So it's possible that this little ego bubble right now is not actually listening to what I'm saying. It's interpreting it, giving what giving its past learning, right? So it's filtering what I say through all the old conditioning and saying that little bubble may be saying, here's what I think he means, rather than what he's actually saying, because of course he couldn't mean what he's saying. The ego bubble never thinks that anybody actually means what they're saying. It's not really interested in what anybody's saying. It's really interested in what it thinks about what everybody's saying. Do you know what I mean? Good, bad, I like it, I don't. It can be both negatives and positive. The ego's not all, you know, negative all the time. It can be good and bad. So I think that's pretty clear. I could go on and on, but I don't think I need to describe sort of the ego. We could talk about it for a long time, but basically, in one sense, the ego, the more dysfunctional it is, the more it is basically, it's not a noun, it's not a thing, it's a verb. That's why a lot of spirituality has generally, with all the talk they have of ego, when they're really talking in a true sense, they will occasionally remind you that this thing that we're talking about, ego, as if it had some sort of existence as a thing that's actually there. It's not. It's a process. It's a phenomena. It's quickly moving conditioned patterns of thinking, acting, reacting. It's very sort of automatic. It's almost like a computer. It's been programmed by society and parents and schooling and nice people and bad people and mean people and pleasant people. And it's all this programming's gone into this thing. So given any circumstance, it almost acts in a mechanical way. It just, boom. That's why when you get to know somebody really well, if you want to ruin their day, it's pretty easy to know how to do it. Right? You know pretty much just the right thing to say. That you can go into that ego and go, And it'll just like go, you know, all day long. You know? So that's this sort of ego structure. We are not born with the ego structure, nor are we born with self structure. Children don't have either one. Infants don't have either one. They start to get sort of a sense of self year and a half to 2.5 years old. Do you know? There was a wonderful and very exquisitely simple experiment about this done decades ago, where they basically looked at when do children recognize their own reflection in the mirror? Because when they start to be able to look at a mirror and go, "That's me," that thing in the mirror, "That's me," that's when self, the rudimentary sense of self has developed. There's not an ego. It's not thinking, I'm not worthy and I'm, you know, crappy and oh my God, you know, my friend hates me because they gave me a crappy Christmas present. It's just like, oh, me. And if those of you who've been parents have seen children do this, it's a wonderful discovery for them. It's like, woo, me. It's like so mysterious. I'm in the mirror. They don't know yet that will lead to some catastrophic results later, but it's a wonderful and it's a very developmental discovery. You know, that's me, you know. And that is the moment when you start to develop self-consciousness. That's me. You can't embarrass a six-month-old infant. Right? They can't get ashamed of themselves. They can be upset because you're not feeding them enough, or because they're too hot, or they're too cold, or they're just having a bad day. You know, but you can't. They don't sit there and have existential dread. They don't feel bad about themselves. They don't feel ashamed. They don't feel guilt. And the reason they don't have any of that is they don't have the capacity for self-reflection. You have to have capacity for self-reflection to be able to pull that off. And that first, those first dawning of self-reflection, of being able to see yourself there. Of course, I think it goes without saying that that is also the beginning of coming out of this sort of undifferentiated consciousness into a consciousness of me, which is the first movement of separation. And that first movement actually is rather pleasant, you know. It's a pleasant discovery. That's why children are like excited about it often. And then as we grow up and we gather experience, more and more conditioning comes in. And at a certain point, then we start to develop sort of an ego. So this self-consciousness has something now to look at. And what it's looking at is its idea of itself. And its idea of the world. And its idea of everything and everybody in the world. And that's that bubble inside the bubble. That's the ego. That the self is simply, self in the way I'm using it is simply that capacity for self-consciousness. Ego is what self-consciousness gets fixated on. Right? And I think everybody knows, or most vast majority of you know, that it tends to, over time, that ego gets more solidified and solidified and solidified and solidified and solidified and solidified and solidified. If you go into the college that's here in Boulder, and you go into some of the dorms, you know, go in there in the evenings after they've gone to college, you know, and I don't know, they're smoking pot in some room, and they're having philosophical discussions about the meaning of life and stuff, do you know? They don't have to be smoking pot, but you know what I mean. You get really philosophical, you know. And there's this exploration of ideas, right? And it's all sort of lots is up for grabs, right? They can change their mind. I mean, some of them are already so solidified they're not going to change anything, but a lot of them, they're still exploring. They're interested. They have these discussions. They want to know what's real, what's true, where they fit in the world, where they don't fit in the world, all that stuff. And you find this around college kids, right? Because their self isn't yet totally solidified. Listen to those same kids when they're in their 40s. And damn it, they'll know what's right. They'll know what should be happening. They will know. They're no longer loose. They're no longer sort of porous. Most of them. Sometimes you do. So to be egoically conscious is to be extraordinarily self-conscious. Self-consciousness is actually what allows us to be conscious of ego. And ego feels more and more and more and more separated. And it feels more and more alienated because ego is for the most part an abstraction. As I said, ego interprets events. It doesn't actually meet them directly. Right? Ego doesn't go out and feel the sun on your face. Ego decides if it likes it, if it's wonderful or not. Ego doesn't just go out the door and notice it's raining. Ego goes out the door and goes, damn it, it's raining again. It's interpreting, right? Ego's not experiencing things simply and purely. What it's experiencing is its interpretation of things. And its interpretation of things is totally and absolutely conditioned. There's no such thing as unconditioned ego.
And the more we that gets solidified, we get more in this sort of abstracted sense of self, this abstracted worldview. Everything becomes at least one or two steps removed, and to the sense that you start to become even removed from yourself. It's one of the interesting things about ego is it makes you feel alienated from yourself. Because in a certain sense, you are. When we're in egoic consciousness, we are alienated from ourselves. We are alienated from our true nature. We're stuck in this deep, deep trance. For some people, it's extraordinarily dysfunctional, conflicted, lots of friction. For others, it's a bit less friction. For some, do you know that God, it's kind of somewhat smooth, but since ego is can't ever be totally smooth, you know. So I call it, some people know how to dream well and some people don't. Most people don't know how to dream well at all. They don't know how to move in the egoic realm in a relatively smooth, easy way. Do you know? Most people are like balls in a billiard game. Do you know? They're bouncing off walls and all over the place, do you know? In the core of that ego, everybody, in the core of everybody's ego, it's like there is this ego does everything to make sure you don't see what's in the core of it. Everything. So much of the noise of the ego is to make sure that you don't experience what's in the core of the ego. Because what's in the core of the ego is what it experiences to be a void. At the core of the ego is nothing. It's a void. It's a void, and it's to the ego. If it was to look into it in an absolutely pure way, if you could visualize it, it would just be visually almost like an absolute darkness, absolute mystery. What's in that absolute darkness, the ego has no possible way of knowing. No matter what somebody tells it, it has no way of possibly knowing. So it experiences this void inside. Most egos, the vast majority, not all, but most egos unconsciously interpret that void as a deficiency within themselves. There's something wrong with me. Because at the deepest level of my being, even if I'm not conscious of it, I have this void. You see, there's this black hole. It often feels deficient. The black hole makes me feel, it reminds me of how alienated I am. It reminds me that my core is nothing, and not a good nothing, a deficient nothing, right? A nothingness nothing, a meaningless nothing. Does that make sense? So for a lot of people, they go through their whole life where this will be totally unconscious to them, because ego, its main agenda is to make sure you never, ever glimpse what's at its core. That's its game. Some egos do it very, you know, seemingly unintelligently. Some egos do it with great intelligence. Does that make sense? So, in other words, it doesn't matter if you're super smart. If you're super smart, have a super high IQ, the ego will use your smartness and your IQ to make sure it never looks there. And if you're more average, you don't have the highest IQ in the world, it'll use that. It'll use anything and everything at its disposal. Unfortunately, for most human beings, though not all, given their life experience, because nobody really gets through the first couple of decades of life, or even through the first decade, without a lot of people in their own way saying, no, you weren't right about that. And in a certain sense, you have to do that. You know, if you tell a kid you're right about everything, you kind of raise a monster, right? A narcissistic monster. Oh, honey, you beat the kid over the head. wow, you put such a nice gash in his head. Well done, you know. It'd be terrible, right? So there's times you got to say, no, you don't do that. That's not so kind. You know, da, da, da. So everybody has lots of experiences where they get no. Some people get no in a loving way, and some people have experienced lots of no's in lots of very unloving ways. It's different for every person. But around this deficiency, those no's start to add up. And they start to feel like there's something essentially wrong with you. You get so many no messages. Something must be wrong with you. Even the good stuff often reinforces that there's something wrong with you. You know, we just went through past Easter, and generally, you know, moms and dads like to dress their kids up at Easter, you know, give them their little Easter outfits. You know, they look smart and everything. And, you know, when the kid, so a little girl, it probably happened to lots of you, or little boys, you're dressed in your Easter finest, you know, you come out, and the relatives are around, and they all see you, you know, if you're a boy, your hair is parted, if a girl, it's just right, and you have a beautiful dress, and you really look lovely, and you feel great, and you walk out, and they go, oh my God, you're so darling, come over, let me get grandma, give you a hug, you're so beautiful, right? If you're lucky, you know. And that all seems good, right? But somewhere deep in your unconscious, you know, deep in your unconscious, when I didn't look this pretty, I didn't get the same kind of hug. So even the good reinforcement, in a very deep unconscious way, it can also reinforce that there's something wrong. In other words, when I'm just myself, you know, if I run out, if I'm 4 years old and I run out in front of all the company and neighbors naked, you know, do I get the same, come here, you cute little thing? In some families, yes. That's nice. That's nice. But not in all. So you get the idea. So even some of the positive ways we get reinforced, they're actually, in an unconscious way, they kind of reinforce an exterior. I'm more loved when I look nice. And it's really fun when you're receiving that love and that appreciation. But somewhere deep inside, you also know, oh, I'm more loved when I look nice. What about when I'm just me? What about when I don't have my outfit on? Do you know? Not that you think about these things, but these things definitely get registered. And so this void, that in and of itself, it's a void in the middle of ego. That's the experience of it. I'm talking experientially, not theoretically or philosophically or theologically. Experientially, there's a void. And the void is just a void. It's just a space of pure mystery. It's not bad or good or deficient or not deficient. It's just a void. But in most people that I will ever meet and that I ever have met, this void is interpreted in a negative way, deficient. Something wrong with me. And if you're not careful, you spend your entire life unconsciously trying to make up for that deficiency. You'll try to be super successful in business, or maybe you'll try to be enlightened, or you'll try to, you know, be the best in the class, or who knows how you'll do it. Or you'll go the opposite way, and you'll say, screw it, I'll find my individuality in darkness, you know. And then you'll start dressing in black and putting needles in your, you know, through your nose and whatever, you know, you do, and to express your individuality, right? problem is there's nothing individual about it because you'll hang out with other people that, you know, just like we all do, right? You know, we think we're so individual and then we look around our group, we go, actually, we're just playing the same game, just in a different way, you know. So you get into something. It could be spirituality. Often it's a traumatic moment. Of course, when you're really young, it could just be spontaneous moments when you kind of just relax. And without even almost even knowing it, you just kind of get pulled into that mystery. And it can be very beautiful for some kids. For other kids, I've talked to lots of people that said, gosh, I remember when I just sort of, when I would let go and I would just disappear. And then I'd start saying my name over and over and over and over to bring myself back. Where am I? I would disappear. It would scare them, you know. Some would have wonderful experiences. But some wouldn't have no experience of that void at all, really, consciously. Certainly when you get into, when something happens in your life, whether it's something traumatic, a death, an illness, an accident, something, divorce, who knows, something traumatic happens. When something traumatic happens, it puts a wrench in our conditioning, doesn't it? All of a sudden, it doesn't work. My feelings are too strong. My emotions are too volatile that my conditioned ways of handling and managing them, they break down. I'm not handling this well, right? And when you start to break down, when your conditioned ways get a wrench in them, for whatever happens, often through, like I said, very difficult moment, that will often sort of create this opening. Many people will run away from it as fast as they possibly can. But often, that, however that opening comes, it's the first time when you really experienced, not knew or believed or hoped, but that you experienced, even if for a split second, you experienced there's something else going on. There is something else going on than anything I ever knew, than anything I ever understood. It's very mysterious, but there's something else. Right in the middle of what seemed like an ordinary day, everything broke down, and all of a sudden, whatever that something else is, appeared. And however that appeared, even if it's for a split instant, from that moment on, to the trajectory of your life is unalterably changed. You don't know that probably at the moment, but it's changed. Whether that happened in an innocent moment in childhood, through a traumatic moment, maybe you got enticed into the promises of spirituality. Should actually be warned about it, but you got enticed into the promises of spirituality and you sat around doing a little meditation or something and some way of looking within and at some moment, just maybe the smallest thing, but some moment you knew something else. There's something else happening. There's something else here than anything that I really have ever experienced. That moment, even if you've forgotten it, forget it, that moment will change the direction of your whole life. And it does. Who knows how it will change it? Some people will run away from that moment with even more vehemence, with even greater energy. Some people will find themselves running towards it. Some people will simply be sort of confused by it. What happened on that day? So since most of us don't really know how to dream well, Because the egoic state of consciousness is sort of a dreamy place to be, right? Since it's the land of interpretations and beliefs and ideas and ideals and self-image and all of that, none of which really corresponds with actually the what-isness of life, the what-isness of reality. That's where most human beings, that's where they live. And we can go from the birth to the grave without ever really living anywhere else. This is the domain, for the most part, this is the domain that psychology tries to address. Every once in a while it tries to go a little bit beyond that, but by and large it addresses this domain, trying to sort of glue Humpty Dumpty back together. Do you know what I mean? You never really totally get it perfectly done. You ever noticed? Do you know what I mean? It never quite, which doesn't mean, you know, you should never undertake the attempt, you know. I don't believe in just to discounting it all, because sometimes, you know, sometimes you whether it's just through a friend, talking to a friend, or sometimes kvetching to your dog, that's always a good person that will listen to you, or a good being, or you go to a psychologist, or whatever. However you do it, you know, there's this whole psychological volatile cocktail. For most people, they're well served with some attention to it, you know? And so the realm of psychology, basically it seeks to kind of make that volatile cocktail of ego less volatile, more functional, more smooth, more sort of flowing and more open and, you know. But it never totally, you never totally arrive, you see. The reason you never totally arrive at the perfect ego state is because there isn't a perfect ego state. There's no such thing. So you can never totally, like, okay, I got it down. Anyway. The authentic forms of spirituality, authentic in the sense of if they move towards or away from awakening, the realization of what you are. There's two ways that can happen. One is you totally give way to that void in the center of your being. Give way doesn't mean you let go into it and keep making all those interpretations of how meaningless it is. That's a very dangerous thing to do. There has been people that do give way, go into the void, but unfortunately, they drag themselves in there with it. They drag themselves into it, and then their little ego sits there in the void and goes, "Oh my God, this void! Life is so meaningless. Oh, it all amounts to nothing." You know, and you can get really sort of chaotically in a very dangerous tailspin. As probably most of us have known people who've done that, or you might have been a person who's experienced that at times yourself. But when you're ready to kind of go in purely, because the ego experiences as a void and an absolute mystery, because ego cannot go beyond it. Ego cannot go beyond its boundaries. It's defined by its boundary. Again, that bubble within a bubble. Ego can never go beyond its boundary, ever. It can think it's gone beyond its boundary. It can imagine what's out there. It can have lots of beliefs about what's out there, but it never makes it anywhere other than where it is. Only when it gives way to that core, and it gives way in a simple way. The giving way, if you go in that route, it often is experienced as a type of death. And I don't mean a metaphorical death. I mean a very real, actual type of death. You know, your body dropping down dead is not the only kind of death there is in life. There are other deaths, and some of the other deaths are actually more significant. Much your body dropping is about the least significant of the deaths. The egoic death, if you go the death route, it can be, it really is a death. I'll go the other way. I don't want to scare everybody, but that's the way it went for me. I found myself being sucked into that. And it was a very, for a short period of time, it was a very violent experience. There was nothing nice about it. There was nothing spiritual. There was no angels waiting there to welcome me in. There was just the ripping away from everything I've known. In fact, ripping me completely out of myself. There was an absolute death into nothing. And so it's not always experienced that violently, but it can have a sort of violent feel. I mean, violent in the sense of energy's blowing, you're seemingly going to blow your body apart, your heart beating so fast it seems like it's going to come out of your throat, you know, that kind of stuff. Not just metaphorical, you know. Really violent. But of course, as soon as it's the identification with ego is pulled apart, that the violence in the snap of a finger is gone. It doesn't even have to diminish. It's just you go from one dimension to another. So it can go from this traumatic experience, as death of ego is a traumatic experience, to an absolutely untraumatic experience as fast, faster than you can snap your fingers. Death of ego doesn't necessarily mean that you'll never have any egoic qualities arise again. If there's a real death of ego, it means all identification with the egoic state has been severed. You cannot raise the dead again. The other way is a little more common, which is the transcendence way. Instead of going into the core, you just sort of let go outside. Does that make sense? It's a safer route to go. It's more gentle. It's nice. It's easier for sure. Do you know? It's what you hear about often in non-dual spiritual circles. Do you know? Just be the awareness that you are. Awareness is transcendent of ego. It's just, ego happens inside of awareness. It happens inside of the witness, whatever you want to call it. It happens, it's something that happens inside of consciousness. You can, a lot of the spiritual, the really direct kind of spiritual pointers are ways of getting you to see. You can take one of the roots, there's lots of roots in lots of different traditions, but you can look into, it's spirituality is most efficiently when dealt with through the lens of identity. Focus right on identity, because then you're getting to the core of everything immediately. You're not like pruning the branches of a tree. You're digging it up by the roots, you know? So when you go to identity and you start to see that everything in this ego structure, every thought you have, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, every story you have, every memory, every interpretation, every belief, even down to what you feel, your reactions, your emotional responses, all of that, it may all be there, so you're not discounting it. But if you really look at any one of those, you realize there's no self in it. There's no self in a thought. A thought's just a thought. There's no self in a feeling. A feeling's just a feeling. And so it goes. Oh, there's this belief. There's no self in this belief. It's just a belief. I'll be darned. I thought I was my belief. I thought I was my thought. I thought I was my self-image. Good, bad, or indifferent. And usually people have all three banging around inside all at once, you know? And if you can disidentify enough, then you just, all of a sudden, this spontaneous letting go, you transcend ego, and boom, you're the witness of it. If you haven't done it, I highly recommend it. It's very freeing, it's very liberating, it's life-changing, all of that. That's the common route. It's a safer route to go. Safer because it's not violent. Death, ego, the ego has a moment of, you know, well, death, you know. Transcendence is not ego death. And as I'm sure many of you know, what you transcend can have the capacity to reel you back in. You may wake up as consciousness or awareness, but that thing that you woke up from, it's still very adept at throwing fish hooks up there and knowing just what lure to put on it so you'll bite. And then, oh, gotcha, with that thought. I'll reel you in with that one. You didn't expect that one, did you? You get onto that one and it goes, oh, I got a new one. I got a million of, let me throw that out into the transcendence. Oh, God. You wouldn't imagine that you could hook vast space, but actually, it'll bite on a hook and you can reel it in, you know? And it reels you back in, you know? So, but of course, once you've tasted that, once you've touched that, even if you get sort of seemingly pulled back into an identification, you somewhere deep inside of you, you know. You know that it doesn't define you. Now, it's possible, in fact, it's very often the case. And given this image that I've given you, it might even seem hard to imagine how it could even happen. But that's why I said don't take this overly concretely. But the ego can actually come out into that transcendent space, and it can kind of become like, ooh, I can do this. I can be nothing. I can be awareness. I can do that. And it's when it's doing that, what it's doing is it's, to use the word somebody brought up yesterday, it's doing that so that it can bypass itself. It's the game the ego plays. It's like, I'll play awareness so I can not have to deal with myself. And it'll work for a while, but it won't work forever. It won't work forever. Because eventually, sometimes that unresolved stuff, that's what kind of keeps that back and forth going sometimes. Even though it's not you, for most people, it takes a while before all the fish hooks that ego casts into the void to where you don't bite on them anymore. It's relatively rare that one has sort of a transcendent awakening and the ego can't throw any fish hooks up that you bite on. Relatively unusual. Happens now and then, but not very often. Usually you kind of get pulled back in, and then you see, oh, okay. And then you get pulled, and you go, oh, okay. You know, back and forth a little bit. If you've really gone the death route, there's an irretrievable separation. That's how you know the difference. If you've gone through the death route, the death route isn't something that can be even seemingly revocable. It's just there can't be a reattachment. That doesn't mean you're God's gift to humanity. That doesn't mean the ego's disappeared necessarily, that it's completely gone. It just means that there's no intellectual, emotional, or energetic hook. It becomes almost like a piece of clothing. Do you know? Well, I shouldn't even say that. In America, you know, we even get hooked by our clothing. I am what I look like, you know. If everybody really, truly, absolutely realized they weren't what they looked like, our economy would completely implode. So everybody thinks, if everybody just awakened all at once, you know, or maybe in 2012, we'll all, the world will awaken. Won't that be great? And I always think, that would be an economic catastrophe. The whole system of the world would go into complete shutdown. I'm not saying that that would be necessarily a bad thing, but it wouldn't be. It wouldn't be like, we all woke up and, It'd be like, we all woke up and 2/3 of us lost our job. I'd be the first one on the unemployment line, by the way. Which wouldn't be a bad thing at all, you know. Not a bad thing. So very often, when people have these sort of waking, authentic awakening from identification with ego, very often they mistake the non-identification with ego with what sometimes they hear of no self. And no ego and no self are completely different experiences. They're frequently lumped together as if they're the same thing, but they're not. They're not even close to the same thing. So they're very frequently lumped together. And often, therefore, when we realize we're not our ego, or especially if we've kind of gone through the sort of the inner core route and it's, there's the severing with the ego has been sort of inextricable, we can conclude that we've had this sort of death experience, this no self experience. But really what happens when we transcend ego or died through it, this bigger bubble that we started with, the bubble, the ego was inside this other, this bubble is totally transparent, isn't it? Totally transparent. And so this, it's very hard to make, to distinguish this bubble from what's outside of it or inside of it, because it's totally transparent. Imagine a bubble that's so transparent that could just be like wobbling in this room, but it has the same transparency as the space in the room. You wouldn't even see it, would you? If it was totally transparent. That bigger bubble, that's what I'm either calling self. This is my definition of self. It's not everybody else's definition of self. Self, or in some spiritual circles, this would be your soul. And when you hit the level of self or soul, it's a transparent, it feels like you're a transparency of almost like pure consciousness. That's what it feels like. That's what it's experienced as. It feels like you're nothing and no one, in a very good way, in a wonderful way, in a beautiful way. That experience, when it's really solidified or stabilized, that's what everybody wants. That's what everybody wants. That's the enlightenment everybody wants. Because it feels great, it's quiet, when it completely kind of stabilizes, it's you don't walk around with this inner division anymore. It, at some point, it can take a long time for some people, but other people it doesn't. The division's not there anymore. It's an extraordinarily pleasant place. So when you hear things like bliss and happiness and well-being and all these sort of very positive terms about about it. That's what they're talking about. So that's basically what everybody wants. Most people want that. It's very easy to mistake that as the final thing. It's very, very easy. Almost everybody does, by the way. It's almost unavoidable because it's so transparent that you can't see it. There's nothing there to see. There's nothing there to touch. There's nothing there to grasp. It's kind of like there's a similarity to the egoic state. You know, you can study for years and years and years about the ego. You can have PhDs in the ego. But the truth of the matter is, you don't really understand ego until you're outside of it. That's when you understand it. That's when you get it. Oh, that's what it is. Because only then are you outside of it looking in. As long as you're inside, you might have a PhD, but you got an insider's view. Do you know what I mean? It's like having the insider's view, the difference between an eagle soaring over the Colorado Rockies and somebody driving in their car or backpacking. Driving in your car through the Rockies or backpacking is a wonderful experience, I can attest to. It's one of my favorite things to do. It's absolutely lovely. But no amount of walking through the Rockies or having PhDs about what it is to walk through the Rockies and all about the... It's none of that is even anything like an eagle flying over the Rockies. Because none of that gets you one inch off the ground. So we really only understand, and this is true about a lot of things, by the way, in life. It's not just a spiritual thing. A lot of things we only truly understand when they're kind of in the rearview mirror. Because only then can we really look at them as a whole and go, oh, I get it. When you're in it, you can understand. It's advantageous to understand it better, of course, when you're in it. But it's totally different than not being in it, you know. So, of course, when you really become stable meaning none of those egoic hooks can really are grabbing you back anymore. In self or soul, however you want to think about it. And in a certain sense, in the way I'm using this term, soul is a transparent thing. So yours and mine and yours and yours and yours, everybody's is the same in that sense. It's actually a universal soul. It's not the soul in the sense of the way it sometimes was used in like ancient Greece as your psyche. It's something bigger than that. And so your internal experience from that level of realization, your internal experience is very good. It's peace. It's well-being. You don't get hooked on things much. You move through things very easy. It doesn't mean everything in life is easy. Sometimes life's easy, sometimes it's not. Sometimes you have challenges, sometimes you don't. It doesn't mean you get a pass on life, do you know? Life is just what life is. But it means internally there's a sort of an immovable sense of well-being. No matter what's happening. So even if you might look like you're challenged in some way, on the inside, you always know everything's perfectly well. It's almost like discovering the eye of a hurricane. You know, the eye of a hurricane, there's no wind. I don't know if you've ever seen the film, I saw it once, of these, what do they call the hurricane chasers or something? These planes, and they're like prop planes from the Second World War that you often use them. They don't fly in there with jets for some reason. I don't know. But they have prop planes, and prop planes fly through the fly into the hurricane. How'd you like to be one? There's your job, you know. You're flying, you know. And I mean, I thought I had a bumpy ride coming into Colorado a couple days ago. I mean, we were getting booted around pretty good. But that's nothing like these guys flying into a hurricane, you know. I mean, that's got to be a combination between courage and insanity. But nonetheless, so this film, and they're filming this plane going into this eye, because it goes into the eye and it kind of has all sorts of scientific instruments, and it is just getting rocked around. I mean, they are violently getting jiggled, and they're showing this, and then all of a sudden, just like that, it's just totally smooth. The eye of the hurricane is totally still, quiet. If you look at it from above, when you see those swirling white clouds and there's that little eye in the middle, there's no cloud, it's blue sky. It's kind of like living there. It doesn't mean nothing, like I said, it doesn't mean nothing ever happens, but it means that eye is always there. So what this self-reflection that we started with, that I started talking about, the two-year-old or the one-and-a-half-year-old has when they just can self-reflect and notice themselves, that self-reflection is now not reflecting upon ego. It's reflecting upon that absolute calmness, stillness, whatever you want to say, well-being. It doesn't mean you can never get angry. It doesn't mean you look or come up to anybody's idea of a saint or any of that kind of stuff. It's not that at all. Something different. But that self-reflection, now that's what it's reflecting on. Almost reflexively. It's just like we reflexively reflect on the ego at a certain point. Just, you don't have to try to do it. You just reflexively conscious of that sort of well-being. Anyway, that's, like I said, that's what people want for the most part. You know, that's wantable, that's desirable. You can want that, you can desire it. It's a good thing. It's good for you, it's good for the people around you, it's good for the world. You, at a certain point when you've been there, you usually will hang out there for some years, and it will be, you'll be kind of just sort of basking in that, and at a certain point there'll be a different sort of movement, and instead of sitting there and grooving on yourself, you know, or your not self, however you want to look at it, instead of doing that, at a certain point it will start to turn outward, and what you'll feel it when it does. When it starts to turn out, where you realize it's not about anymore about me, just how I feel in any given, how my well-being. It turns outward, and you realize it's time now to bring that into expression. That's what the Bodhisattva vow is all about, right? The Bodhisattva vow is basically it's. It's not something really that you sit there and you take in a formal ceremony. You know, you can do that. No, you know, that's all well and good. But what it really is when this natural turning outward happens. And you realize, so it's like to be not because you're trying to be spiritual or loving or whatever. None of that. But to bring this out and to express it and manifest it in the world is now what's called for. And that is, when you sense that, you know, that's more important than sitting around gazing into your own eternity. That's infinitely more important at that point in time. However that's done, it doesn't mean you have to do something fantastic in the world or anything like that. And it should not be done ahead of its time. It often is. When people experience what I'm talking about, often when they just begin to experience it, they're like, I gotta go save the world. I'm gonna go tell everybody, okay, I'm gonna go out and, you know, they get very sort of non-dualistically evangelical, you know? So there's a tendency to sort of prematurely want to, like, you know, tell everybody the good news, you know? But usually you do that when you're still on your spiritual honeymoon and... Anyway. So now imagine the sense of well-being, however you want to think about that. That without trying to do it, without intending it, just the way that self-consciousness looks in, that it looked in and basically saw that sense of well-being and also love. And there's compassion that flows kind of naturally. You're not trying to be loving or compassionate or anything, but it kind of just, it's just the way that it moves. You know, it's not a personal thing. It's just the way that that place moves. It's just how it moves. And then imagine, first I'll give you the sudden version. It doesn't usually happen sudden, but just imagine if all of a sudden one day, it was as if somebody came up to that bubble with a pin and just went, and it popped. And your whole nirvanic world went with it. And all of your inner experiences went with it. Just... That's about as close as I can describe the actual experience of the falling away of self. That's what no self is. That's not really what it is because those are words, but that's the closest I can come. What no self really means, it's often interpreted as no ego. It's not. What really no self really means is no soul. Not, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that as in terms of going beyond that. So usually it doesn't happen that quickly. Usually it's not like a pop. Usually this dimension of being, without you knowing about it, is slowly ebbing away and probably started ebbing away before you even had any waking up kind of experience. It started to ebb away. But for those of you who were here yesterday and I talked about those two streams of spirituality, there's the sexy part, which is all about the realizations and the ahas and the sudden and often transformative shifts of consciousness or perception. And then there's this other stream, which is the subterranean, very quiet. There's no bells and whistles. It's not about ahas. If anything, it's about, oh, no. As the self sort of inextricably ebbs away, right? Ebbs away. Not only self in terms of thought and idea, because that's mostly ego stuff. Is it when it's thoughts and ideas. But out here in what I call self or soul, it's not ideas, it's a type of consciousness, it's a type of self-consciousness. It's the best self-consciousness there is because it's very blissful. And it's also, there's a type of energy to it. Just like the ego has an energy. Ego is not just thoughts and ideas and memories and quickly moving patterns of conditioning. I think we all know that. That's not what it is it? That's not all that it is. Because there's those things called feelings and emotions, and they're connected with all those thoughts, of course. But there's feelings and there's emotion, and then underneath feelings and emotion, there's this type of raw driving force. if you want to have a sense of like the ego driving force, and I don't mean this as in judgment or even in a negative way whatsoever. I'm just using this as person as an example because it's very obvious. When you look at someone very successful, let's say like Donald Trump, you if you sense in his energy, there is an immense driving force, right? Now, often it doesn't have to look like Donald Trump because, you know, you can make him into a bad guy and all. But I'm just using it in the sense you have an intuitive sense there's an intense driving force in that man, right? That driving force is in everybody. For him, it's so narrowed and focused that it's got this sort of laser beam intensity, and that's why it's easy for almost anybody to see and feel. For other people, their driving force is much more diffuse. You know, they want to succeed at lots of different things. They want to be liked and successful. They want to be rich and spiritual. You know, they don't just want one thing. Whatever that is, you know, own more buildings in New York than anybody else. I don't know what it is, but so it's diffuse, but it's the same energy. Self also has an energy. It's not the same as ego. Of course, the more stable you get in self or soul, the more egoic energy disappears, which can be very odd and confusing as that egoic driving force of your life starts to disappear on an energetic level and you don't feel driven towards all those things that you used to feel driven by or towards. It's a real adjustment. Self or soul or spirit has a much more very positive driving forces. Love, compassion. These are very positive sort of driving forces. I could name others, but there's mostly they're very positive energy that pushes you forward. And when that bubble pops, those go with it too. So when the sages of old and sometimes of present have said the truth is beyond good and evil, beyond right and wrong, beyond love and hate. Nowadays, in our current non-dual environment, it's all so sort of hip and almost casual that these terms are used in very imprecise ways. But they originated from a very precise experience. A very exact, precise experience. Whereas when the positive motivating energy, the negative is no longer there, then the positive is there and the positive motivating energy falls away. Can you get a sense of how no underlined no self is on every level you can think of, intellectually, theologically, experientially, emotionally, energetically, on every level, it's not that. Which sounds horrendously negative. It doesn't sound good. That's why it's never part of the sales pitch for enlightenment. Because it's the enlightened self that sounds good. That's where all the positive stuff is. That's where all the good stuff is, you know. But the falling away of that, it's positive, but it's positive beyond positive. And you can only explain that, you can only know that by having experienced it. It's something it is beyond good and evil, right and wrong, love and hate. That doesn't mean there's no love in you. That doesn't mean you can't feel love or appreciate. You know, it doesn't mean you're bereft of, you're just sort of some clod sitting there, not thinking, not feeling, not moving, not, you know what I mean? It sounds like that, but it's not. It's about the most alive place there can ever be. And only there are there no boundaries, no divisions. There's no unity because there's nothing to be unified. It's not really even oneness, although you can call it that. Oneness is much more of a what I'm calling soul or witness or whatever you want to call that place. It's more that place. It's not one, it's not diversified. Anyway, I don't want to go on about that. I think the relevant part of it is that kind of diminishing of self in small ways is inextricably happening for probably almost everybody in this room. It's diminishing. The trajectory of where spirituality points towards, that's the trajectory that it goes in. For a while, it doesn't seem to go that way. There might be some people in here today that kind of were like, came in like all bushy-tailed and full of juice and like, woo, you know, and all excited. And that's fine. That's a great sort of, you know, phase sort of to be in. And it's all very interesting and it's more energetic and it's more exciting. It's, you're devouring teachers and teachings, you know, like some joyously ravenous monster, you know. But it's lovely. It's lovely. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing too. And so for that person, this may not sound very appealing, you know, at all. You know, but like, it's always one of the things that I came to me kind of out of nowhere one day was when I realized everything's a phase. Everything. Boy, does that help with the not grasping and the not worrying. Everything's a phase. The good and the bad, it's all a phase. The way Buddha put it was, it's all impermanent. But for me, that was always a little bit abstract. Do you know? To see that whatever you're experiencing, whether it's excitement or difficulty or happiness or sadness or grief and despair or bliss and love, you know, everything's kind of, it's a phase. It moves, doesn't it? Life moves, it undulates, it changes. I mean, you'll go through phases in this single day. You'll go through phases. Then you'll go through bigger phases. And then you go through sort of mega phases, you know? So everything's sort of a phase. But this inextricable falling away, dissolving of self, is part of people's experience. The reason I'm talking about it more and more is because more and more people are experiencing more and more of it. And what I mean by that is wherever I go, when I go to talk, wherever people are in this sort of way that I presented this, my bubbles, theory of bubbles, which, by the way, hold very, very lightly. Don't hold them too hard. Don't take it too seriously. Is because more and more I feel I talk to people where they're experiencing parts of self diminishing. And it comes usually in the wake of their own realizations. And if you really kind of, if you understand it, if you get that it's part of your unfolding, it can happen much more with much more ease. And you can actually, it's not always, but at certain times you can really enjoy it. You know, it's nice to have certain things just kind of like, now, where did that piece of myself go? You ever had that experience? You suddenly notice, like, where did that reactivity go to that? When did I get, I don't know, but it's like some piece of, like, an ice, you know, broke off an iceberg and melted away. And a lot of times, you don't even know when it happened. You know, you kind of know in retrospect, like, oh, that's missing. Oh, and that's missing. And you always notice when you notice something like that is missing, unless you're getting a weird mind space about it, it's like, and that's nice. It's nice to have that missing, and it's nice to have that, and it's nice. And that's part of the way it goes for quite a while, you know? And then sometimes things fall away, and you're like, hey, I didn't plan on that, do you know? I mean, I can remember when I first started to teach. I had my own version of a certain evangelical kind of energy. You know, I think most teachers do. Fortunately, I didn't take it too serious. I didn't take myself too seriously, which was really fortunate. And it kind of ran its course. But it was like this beautiful, motivating energy. You know, it's lovely, and you're just full, as they would say probably in Christian circles, it was full of the Spirit, and just, oh, you know what I mean? It was just, and it was lovely, do you know? For me, it was lovely. I think for most, because most people tend to groove on that kind of energy when they encounter it. It's enlivening. It's uplifting. Do you know that? And then after some years, all of a sudden, you know, and I used to have this thought. I thought I would look at people, and I would just think like I would be completely just absorbed in this. I can't even explain it. It was just the truth. Every ounce of my energy, my focus, my everything, I was there 24 hours a day, every day. There wasn't a second when it wasn't with me. Just beautifully driving along like a locomotive, you know? And it was lovely. And I would look and I'd go, how could anybody not be like this? And I don't mean like a judgment. There was no judgment. It was confusing. Like, how could you not? This fire is so amazingly wonderful. How could anybody, especially the people who tasted it, how could they not be consumed by it 24 hours a day? And there was nothing in me that could imagine it would ever be any other way. 3 or 4 years later, I feel like an old dog on the porch, you know? Or like, you know, some old guy sitting in his rocking chair on the porch. He's not concerned, he's not worried, you know, he's not in a rush, he's not driven even by the wonderful. But I remember as I started to change, I would think, this is odd. This powerful, beautiful energy, it's just draining out of my system. All the evangelical quality disappeared, you know. All the sense of, I have mission and message and all that kind of, just. And boy, was it amazed me as how much it could disappear. So it's not only the conflicted energies that disappear. Sometimes the ones you really like and groove on disappear. I don't mean try to get rid of them. They all have their time and place, like everything else in life. It has its time and its place, and then when it's ready, it drops off. Kind of like fruit on a tree. When it's ready to drop, it just drops. You know? But you can feel, this is what I feel when I travel now, which is very different than 8 or 9, even 5 years ago. I tried to talk about this stuff like 12 or 13 years ago. Forget it. I would get like the energy of daggers from audiences. Literally, I was like, all I wanted to hear was, you can wake up now and everything will be fantastic when you do. And that's it. It's the end of the line. That's what they wanted to hear. Do you know what I mean? And nothing else, do you know? Now, when I talk about this stuff, it sounds like very, you know, it doesn't objectively sound really exciting. But it's fascinating that now it's completely different atmosphere now. Which isn't good thing, because it shows that many, many, many more people are sort of, they're spiritually maturing, you know, as happens. And like I said, it can cause certain confusions, you know, where did the vroom, the zest to become go? Where did the driving force of my personal life go? Where did the oomph? Does that make sense? And you can either think something went wrong, or you can be confused by it. Or when you realize it's just a natural part of it, then you can just let it happen. That doesn't mean it's going to be every part of it's going to be easy. You know, there's an adjustment to every phase. And yesterday we talked about some of those adjustments people brought up that were not easy for them. You know, it's a deep misunderstanding that just because you get fairly clear spiritually, that number one, that's the end of the line. That's a big misunderstanding. And the other misunderstanding is that when this falling away phase starts to gain momentum, that something is kind of going wrong, or that it's always going to be easy. You know? People think if it's not easy, then the person hasn't had any authentic awakening. You know what I mean? If they're struggling at all, well, it wasn't really real. You know, that kind of stuff. That's nonsense. And for some people, it's very easy. For some people, it's just like, you know, water sliding off a duck's back. For some people, it is. And as I said, in general, that falling away of self is something that starts very early in your spirituality. It starts early. You don't even know it started, though. And as you go, it gains momentum the more you realize. And at a certain point, you start to experience that you get this intuition. It may not be clear, that's why I'm mentioning it, but you get this intuition that it's like, oh, okay, what's being called for now isn't more grand moments of aha. Those may or may not come. But you feel when you're, it's like your spiritual life has shifted into a different gear, and it's about something very different. And if you know that when that time comes, then you're not trying to solve everything through great moments of aha. You see what I mean? You're not, you can waste a lot of time and energy. Instead, you just sort of sense the way things are going and you just kind of give way to it. And when you do, you realize even though it may not sound good, it's actually extraordinarily beautiful. And then there's no push-pull in you, even positive pull or push. You know, then sort of life just expresses itself however it's going to express itself through you. Okay. We got 15 minutes, do we? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll take a question or two, see if there's any questions about it. Right on the aisle, come on, with the gray t-shirt kind of thing, glasses. Hop up, my friend. Yeah. Great.
Hello? Okay.
Hi.
Hi. We had a conversation in San Diego about a year ago about veterans.
Oh, yeah, you gave me the card. Right. I was hoping you'd come up.
Okay. And you referred me to Richard Miller.
Yeah.
And we've had a great exchange and about that. And so we were talking about trauma and what goes on with in this non-duality thinking. And what I came back around with, which is, I happen to be in town today, which is for the families, it's really more about holding a space for what's going on, and I'm asked to help a lot, and I'm not struggling as much now with it, but it's hard to communicate to somebody about what they're going through and how to hold a space for somebody when they're going through their problems, or worse yet, when they're experiencing loss for the families. And so I wanted to throw out that that's kind of a real world.
It sure is.
Dilemma.
Huge dilemma.
How do you process non-duality with those kinds of like catastrophic
situations? For me personally, to tell you the truth, I never, ever, ever think about non-duality. I just don't think about it. I'm much more interested in like what's actually happening. Do you know? I'll use the language when it suits what I want to communicate. But I in other words, I don't take like non-duality and put it on top of anything. I think when you look at like what you just said this is a very profound thing that many, many people are living with, right? These veterans, bless their hearts, that come home from these terrible wars, and then their families that are like this, my God, what do I, they're experiencing this person, and they literally have no connection, do they, with what they're experiencing. And the soldier, whoever he or she may be, they know that that person who's never been there, they know they can't know. And that can be a really difficult thing. It makes the family members often feel very frightened, very insecure, very afraid, because now there's somebody that's very important to them, and they don't really get what they're experiencing. They don't really understand it. And if someone's at all inwardly insecure, that's going to come to the front. That's going to come to the fore. You know, everything's going to blossom.
I agree. You shouldn't use terms. Like, it might be too esoteric.
Yeah.
You know, but I think the experience that I experience most is the feeling of not being able to help someone.
Yeah.
Right, when you've raised them or something.
Yeah.
Or been with them. So that's really creating an ability to be with that. Helplessness.
Yes, I think it is. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important, because there's because that is a place for you to enter also, right? That you don't have the answer for all these guys, for all these women, for their families. You don't necessarily, there's not a quick... But it seems to me what I've always seen is when we enter into really not knowing something together, and we can really allow ourselves to go there together, really not know what to do or how to even help or if to help, or when we can really enter there, I find over and over again that that's where magic happens. Is we have to be able to go into that place, and not have the answer to everything. To have the answer come out of our willingness to meet. I think there's a thing about human beings. I think one of the things that we so much crave is just somebody meeting us. Do you know what I mean? Just meeting us. And so often if somebody's coming and there's that energy of, I'm helping you or I'm going to do something, that can get in the way too, can't it?
Your intentions, yeah.
Even your good intentions can kind of, get in your way.
Yeah, I think I've experienced some of that. You can't create anything new from what you already know.
Right.
So not knowing is a scary place.
Because what might have been really significant in helping somebody, one person, might not actually be significant at all in helping the next person. Hmm. You know, often they have a whole different matrix of, you know, experience. Am I getting to what you're...
Yeah, it's reinforcing this helplessness you find, with a lot of families, and helping them be comfortable with not knowing what to do is really a big part of breathing and just helping them relax that it's okay to not know what to do because you can't create anything new from there.
Right.
And so it takes them out of the stuck state.
Yeah.
And it can be helpful.
I think, yeah, it can be very helpful. There's nothing like honesty. I remember, this was many years ago, there was this person that used to come to see me that had terrible problems with rage. Terrible, terrible problems. And I mean, even coming to Satsang, this person would sometimes just talk about blowing up, just really, really blown up. And then at one point we were talking together, and I was having to tell this person, I really can't let you come on a retreat. I know you want to go on one, but it's just too volatile. I can't put everybody in that place with you. And they really opened up. I mean, they were coming because they really wanted help, right? So this person really sort of opened up and said, I don't know what to do. You know, I've tried all this stuff for, you know what I mean? It was literally like 5 or 6 decades trying various things. And I said, you know what? I'll be honest with you. I don't know what to do either. I have no idea what to offer you. I have no idea what you need. I really have no idea. I would love to know. I usually have some sort of intuitive, real sense that I know. But actually, you know what? I really don't know. And there was a way in which we met, do you know, in that moment. It wasn't necessarily that you had a big warm fuzzy, but we were both in the same place. Do you know? You don't know. And, hey, guess what? I don't know either. And interestingly, this person contacted me about a month later. And when they'd finally, you know, kind of given up anybody having their answer, and they're sitting on the couch one day, and this whole scenario occurred that I won't explain, but this whole scenario, or just sitting on the couch alone, and it just resolved itself. And this person became such a loving, like as rageful as they were, they became that loving. And I used to go into this town where, and people would be like, we don't believe it. I don't believe it, Aja. I don't believe it. It's not real. It's fake. It's phony. And they go, what do you think? And I go, looks pretty real to me. I think it's real. And that went on for a couple years. Like, and people would literally come up to me and go, that's not real. I know it's not, you know. And they had good reason to. But I'll be darned, after about three, it took 3 or 4 years for some people to kind of go, well, I'll be damned, it's real. But, I mean, that's a nice ending to a story, of course. Not every story ends like that. But I just say it because I really have found that when our honesty is synonymous with our intimacy. So if we can be totally honest that we don't even know the next thing to do or to say, if you can enter that space, you help other people enter that space. That space becomes a little less frightening to them, becomes a little bit more okay to them. And it's like in an energetic way, you're like saying, yeah, come on in to where you already are anyway. It's okay not to know. It's okay to feel what you feel, to be scared and to be, you know, all these things that you feel and all that kind of stuff. I find it very powerful.
Thank you.
You're so welcome. Yeah. Glad you're doing that work. fact, I just watched a video that somebody left me last night. It was, what's that called? Something Eli or Ela? The book of, not the book. Anyway, it was a movie about a particular soldier returning from, or a particular group of soldiers returning from Iraq. Very, very, very well done. Very touching. Red hair. Come on up. Do we have time? We have 3 minutes. That's plenty. Wait, come on up here. We do have enough time to you to come to the mic.
I can't believe you talk. I'll explain it as fast as I can.
Okay. Bless your heart.
I met you a year ago in Philadelphia. I'm the woman who wants to jump into the void. Mm-hmm. And you said to me, Spirit says no. Mm-hmm. I never really heard you say no to anyone before. I was really quite surprised. A lot has happened in a year. And what I hesitated on asking you, you actually addressed in your talk. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, this is the anniversary of my new life. 2 years ago, a phenomena happened to me, and I didn't understand it when it happened, mm-hmm. but eventually I came to you and your teaching. And I want to describe it to you, because I'm sure there's other people out there who've had something like this, and they say, oh, I'm never going to tell anyone this. So I would like to tell you, and I'd like to know the name of it, because I'm so grateful for the experience. I'm just so grateful for it. I'd like to be able to call it something except something, you know?
Yeah, I do.
All right?
I do.
And at the same time, I was afraid to tell you because it, like, exposes my ego all over the place. So here it is. I find myself standing in the bathroom.
Yep.
I don't know how I got there. I get messages, by the way, and I heard 4 statements. The first one is, what are you doing? I immediately felt guilty. The second one was, the life of the small self is over. The third one was, you're needed elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Serve others. I went crazy, jumped up and down. What is this? What do you mean? You can't leave me here. I went crazy. Do you want my body? You can have it. You can have it. Because after this experience, I realized I never wanted to be born. Mm-hmm. So it brought all of that up to the surface, and now I understand why when I was a teenager I wanted to be old, because I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. I still prefer the formless existence, but now I'm beginning to see joy, appreciate life, and I've never been happier.
Yeah. Lovely.
What was that? Because when it stopped and I stopped yelling, reality shifted, and everything became horrible looking. It's like something was extracted from life, and it was ghastly. I was going to kill myself, but then I decided, no, that's going to hurt people too much, but I'll pray to die. And that went on for several months. 2 things happened to help me. One is my friend Marcia sitting over there.
Always good to have a good friend.
Reconnected after 20 years, and our story is really wild. And the other thing is, this book kept flashing in my mind, and the book that I bought 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the book, the cover of the book says Transformations of Consciousness, and I opened it to Existential Crisis.
There you go.
After the experience, I really wanted to jump out of planes with parachutes and do bungee jumping, and I just had urges, but I have no money, so I can't do it. What was that experience? What can I call it? Because of my gratitude towards it. And now I don't feel so bad about telling it, because you just said it's some core ego experience.
Oh, it's lovely. It's lovely.
Yeah, well, what do I call it?
I don't know.
I mean,
I would call it being gifted.
I hear people's transcendent awakeness thing, you know, and that wasn't what happened to me.
Yeah.
Afterwards, I had my ego almost chopped down to the knee. It was like a 1-2 punch.
Yeah.
And I just had no I had no ambition, nothing, and I still don't, and I love it.
It moved in the opposite way that you wanted to move, right? It's sort of be a loving presence here now. You know, it's different than I really didn't want to be here. I didn't want to.
Yeah.
And it's a totally opposite message, isn't it?
Well, what was it?
It's what it was, dear.
I mean, but is that, I mean, it's not, it changed
my
entire focus.
You don't need to put it in a box.
I know you don't want to.
I know it'd probably be nice to know where it all fits
in
the greater.
But I say this thing happened to me.
Yeah.
And I wanted to grace it with a name.
Yeah. How about Grace?
All right.
How about...
Yeah. Grace happened.
That sounds good.
Grace happened.
God's gift, you know, whatever.
Okay.
Because we do get gifted at times, right? Get gifted just like out of nowhere.
Out of the blue.
They're beautiful.
What did it mean by you're needed elsewhere? That means that something knows who I am. and that I know how to do something, which I have no idea what it is.
I'll leave you with that one.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't touch that. I wouldn't take that one away from you. In Zen, we would call that, the life gave you a koan. It gave you a riddle.
Oh, a riddle.
And it's something that you just live with it. Mm-hmm. Live with that. What is that? What does that mean? Live with that.
Yeah, yeah. What does that
Don't
mean?
Worry about it, you know. Just yeah. like, yeah.
Okay, so that's not an awakening, right?
don't try to classify it.
All right.
It's really the disease of spirituality.
Yeah.
Is we all like I have to call it this and what I mean?
Yeah.
And I mean sometimes it's fine to name something and to kind of see how it fits in, but something like what this is a gift that was given just specifically for you, for right where you were. It's not a gift. It doesn't belong to be put in any ideology, anything. It's just, I would just take it as a gift, as really what it was. Anything else would be to diminish it.
Blessings for your being.
Thank you,
Thank
my
you.
Dear.
Thank you.
Bless you. Thank you. Okay. Well, that was much more quickly done than when I usually say 3 minutes. I mean, that wasn't bad, huh, Spencer?